Welcome to another episode of Sharing the Hope from the Mike and Mason Foundation. I'm your host, Patrick Mason. I'm joined today by Amy Earhart.
Hello, how are you?
Just peachy. How are you doing?
I'm freaking fantastic.
So unlike the vast majority of my interviews, we're actually in the same room.
Really?
For this. Yeah.
Okay.
Most of mine I do are over Zoom or over the internet. So
this is interesting. I have only done one, I think, face-to-face interview as well. So yeah, I'm excited for this.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
See where it rolls.
All right. So I met Amy at NPC QIC fall learning session. I was about to say spring, but it's fall now, in St. Louis, and learned that she also has a podcast.
Yes. Diaries of a Heart Warrior, which I don't think I started to much or after this one.
Okay.
Right? Is that what you said?
So I started this about 2 years ago, I would say. So yeah, it was the fall learning session prior. So wherever that was.
That was last year was St. Louis. Mm-hmm. The year before was
Chicago. Yes. So it was Chicago. It was the Chicago one that was outside the city, not the Chicago one that was inside the city where it snowed. I don't know if you read them.
Yeah, I was not. My first one was the Chicago outside of the city.
Okay.
And fell in love with them.
Yeah.
Going back ever since.
Yeah, those are wonderful. So I assume you go to the single ventricle patient's day.
Yes.
Stuff.
Yes.
Okay. As a parent, I'm extremely interested in what goes on.
Well.
What are you allowed to tell me from those secret meetings?
So let me tell you this. Year one that I went in Chicago, I thought the single ventricle day was amazing. We sat down at tables. We actually, that day, there were also physicians in the room prior to and had candid conversations. There were questions on the table. We kind of talked about things. After that, the physicians left and families kind of left, and we intermingled for a short while. Last year, I felt was very different. Mm-hmm. We went in a room, we kind of ate lunch, and that was about it. Whatever dialogue came out of it, the dialogue came out of it.
Okay.
So good, bad, and different, however you like your single ventricle day to look, I think the people you meet there in general, you're sitting with, and then you're having those conversations and learning about them all at the same time. So I did meet Megan prior to.
And I have not been able to interview her yet.
She's freaking wonderful.
I know, one of these days.
Yeah.
Get her on.
She's wonderful. So I had met her through doing my podcast, and we were texting and we knew we were going. So we sat together a lot. And there was another gentleman, Andrew, who was also there, who we had met the year prior, and we sat together for that day. But again, it was kind of a lunch. So everyone was kind of eating, doing their thing, and then it was over.
Yes.
So is there anything major that happens in these? I'm going to say I haven't found that piece yet. No.
Okay. Okay.
So.
But fellowship, though.
Yes, 100%.
Yeah.
I think through this going, I'll say two things. One, going to NPCQIC the last 2 years has done wonders for me to meet people and really feel part of the community. And two, starting the podcast, meeting people through the podcast and just getting to know them, exchanging phone numbers, texting each other when things come up. Again, I'll mention Megan again because she's so fantastic. But I was doing something with my Facebook page and I'm like, I can't decide. And she's like, hit the button. Just like, you won't regret it. Just hit the button and share it.
Just do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's those things too, because she's been doing that forever. Through Facebook, she's had her own page, and there's a lot of people who have had their own page, and it's just getting the encouragement from everyone else to say, this isn't a dumb idea. People will eventually find you. They will follow you and follow your journey.
Yep.
So that's what's been really cool about it too.
Okay. Good deal. Okay. So what caused you to want to start a podcast?
Oh my Lord. So it actually wasn't even in my wheelhouse. Before I turned 40, I decided I was going to stop drinking. And through that, just to kind of get a little heads up on the quitting drinking aspect, I decided to join some, I wouldn't even say they were women's groups, but they were groups that were geared towards helping people to stop and finding your purpose.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So with all this, people were talking about podcasts. And I'll be honest, a CHD podcast was the last one I wanted to do because I was still at the point where I'm like, I'm not ashamed of it. I want to be part of the community, but I don't know if that's what I want this podcast to be about. And I sat on it for, I don't know, I'll say a few months. And then finally, what do you know? One day out of the blue, this podcast, like 8-week class, comes up on my Facebook. And I thought to myself, well, I'll do the 5-day boot camp. And I did the 5-day boot camp. And I thought, this literally takes me through everything I need to know about how to podcast, start to finish. And when I was, after that 8 weeks, when I was done, I thought to myself, if I can figure out how to get something uploaded to Apple, and this is my trailer, maybe I can do this. And after 8 weeks, I actually did. So I was like, okay, well, maybe this could be a thing. That's how Diaries of a Heart War was birthed. It was kind of a crapshoot. I didn't anticipate doing a podcast, and it really, the idea, and I would have let it go if the boot camp didn't show up and then the 8-week thing came after. So,
I mean, it's funny how every time I talk to people, there are providential things like that that happen. Like, yeah. I never would have done this if it hadn't been for this other semi-unrelated thing.
Yeah.
So,
100%.
Yeah.
So I'll ask you the same question. What prompted you to do a CHD podcast?
So it was twofold. I've been involved in podcasting for almost 20 years. I started a podcast with a neighbor about, ostensibly, it was about working on cars. We never talked about working on cars. We talked about teaching. We talked about power. We do, you know, our jobs. So we talked about all kinds of stuff. We had about a season's worth of episodes. It died after that. Eventually, we both moved away. I still keep in touch. I'm going to get to see him in September. I'm super excited. I hadn't seen him. He's moved to North Carolina. I'm in Texas now. We were living in Louisiana at the time. About 6 years ago, I started another podcast, and it was just something I did. And I don't know, about 3 years ago, I started getting involved in an actual podcast organization. I'm now a guest on 3 or 4 different shows. Podcasting just became part of who I was. I don't know how to put that, but like, and don't get me wrong, like, you know, most narcissistic human beings, I enjoy hearing myself talk. So podcasting was just something that was in my wheelhouse, that was just part of my skill set. And I had started this charity back in 2018, 2017. And, you know, it kind of fits and starts about stuff we were trying to do, things we were trying to do, trying to figure out what's my place in all of this stuff in the CHD and more particularly the HLHS community, the groups I was working with, what I was doing. And something I kept encountering again and again and again, and I still encounter it on Facebook, social media groups, primarily Facebook, are the stories of people who are diagnosed, get the diagnosis, typically in utero, occasionally not, because we were not. And all they see for the first 48 hours is doom and gloom. It's terrible. Like, you know, everything's over. Nothing's good, right? And that just isn't the case. It's not the case anymore. Obviously. I'm sitting in a room with the person who has HLHS. 4 years old.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's not the case, but it's not out there. And so the idea behind the podcast is, well, let's get that out there. So the name Sharing the Hope came from that concept. And that's the idea behind it. I really love talking to people about their individual journeys. I love talking about scientists, about their stuff and discoveries, all the things that are going on, all the different movements going on. And that is, I think, in a large way, my calling as a human being is very much as connective tissue. I view myself as a connector, one person to another, whether or not I guess, you know, I could be a catalyst. Like, as if I get two people to meet and then never hear from me again, that's fine. As long as it's the right two people. And that's what I view the podcast as being.
I love that your perspective is that way, is the way of showing parents the diagnosis is not the end.
Yeah.
My thought behind the whole thing was I felt like I was the only one. So to show people, I'm 40 with HLHS, there are XYZ hundreds out here. We're all going through a similar journey at a different speed, not on necessarily the same road at the same time, but the journey's there. And essentially, we're not the only one.
Yeah.
That's where my thought process was. And it was very interesting and I'm assuming, but when I first started, the running theme was, when I was younger, I thought it was the only one. And that's really disheartening to know. And on the flip side, being a parent, it has to be really hard to feel like your life or your child's life, for lack of better words, may not go anywhere. So two very different perspectives
there,
which is wild.
I think in a lot of ways that they're extraordinarily similar, because most parents feel like they're the only ones at the same time. One of the things I really love about your podcast is that you don't just focus on, like, I have a very kind of strict focus on what can you do and what is the research and what is the science and the doctors involved and people like yourself with HLS who are doing amazing things to showcase. Yes, it's not darkness.
Yeah.
Right. And your podcast is so much like, this is living. We're all still just human beings and we have lives and we have things we have to deal with. And like, I love, you have an entire episode that's about pregnancy.
Yeah.
And that's,
thank you,
just a human being thing. And it's slightly different because of the heart disease, but it's still just a human being thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's, for me, the personalization of all of it. And as an interviewer having HLHS, every time I interview someone, there's so often where I'm like, oh my gosh, I feel I went through that same thing at some point in my life, yet it was now for me, maybe so long ago. But the fact that we're out here, it's unbelievable to me how parallel the lives are. And yet so different because of the different ways we've grown up and how it all pans out and works out.
Good.
Yeah. I love hearing the individual stories is what it is.
When you first started your podcast, how did you start? Who were you, like, when you were, okay, I'm going to interview this person. How did you figure that out?
So here's the wild thing. When I first started the podcast, I knew a few people in the CHD world already. And I knew that I could contact them and, will you be on my show? Beyond that, I grew up in a very small town. And there was a girl who graduated with my sister who decided one year to get a proclamation signed in our community for CHD week. When that happened, myself and my younger sister called her and said, where do you plan on going with this? And she's like, I have no idea. Not knowing, really, she was a part of all these mom groups on Facebook because she also had a daughter with a CHD. Come to find out, there are a lot of people within my community with CHD. So wildly enough, I was born with CHD. My cousin had a daughter with CHD. My other cousin had a son with a CHD. So right in my family, I immediately knew, clearly, here we are. Finding out through what Alicia was doing and bringing things forward, there were other people in my hometown who had children with a CHD. So it really just originated with Kaleida and then knowing some of the people I already knew. And then from there, I decided to put it on the different platforms and people just started coming.
Okay.
Which is best case scenario, because at the beginning, again, I had no idea. I still don't know what I'm doing. So let's be honest. I still don't know what I'm doing. But as difficult as it is sometimes, I don't necessarily think it's hard finding the people because you're part of the platforms and you're so interconnected. So that's kind of how it originally started. That's where I started. I would love to have more providers, physicians, and all the things on. But I am not confident enough to say, hey, would you mind coming on my podcast? The only person I've ever done that with, and I don't know if you've listened to the episode, is my surgeon who did my Fontan, Dr. Davis.
Okay. I don't think I've listened to that one yet.
He moved to Columbus and he was part of Nationwide Children's. And I knew that. And I hadn't seen him for years. He's actually a part of the band in Columbus. And so I started being a weirdo. Let's just put it that way, and started following him.
So your Facebook stalking. You're old surgeon. Okay. Well, all right.
Found out he was in this band. I'm like, where are they playing? What are they doing? So I started going to different things. And then eventually, it was this past year, I went to one of his gigs per se, and I went up to him and I said, hey, I don't know if you remember me, and little jingle of the brain. And his eyes were like, oh my gosh. And I was there with my husband and a couple friends, and podcast has already started. And they said, did you ask him to be on it? And I'm like, no, why would he want to be on my podcast? I'm not asking. And Brad was like, you don't ask him, I'm asking him. And I'm like, oh my gosh. So they were in the middle of a set. And I thought to myself, oh, dear Lord, how am I going to ask him to be on this? And I literally just said, hey, I started a podcast. Do you want to come on and talk about stuff? And he was like, I would love to. So I immediately said, I have got to get this scheduled. He's older now. I mean, he's in his 80s.
Yeah.
So my thought was, if I don't do it, I'm going to regret it for the rest of my life.
Yep, yep.
And I did it. And it was probably one of the best things I've ever done. Just hearing where he started, how he came and how he learned to do the surgeries. He said, you know, he started out, I think, in Pitt or Philadelphia. I can't remember. And then he decided to move to Toledo, Ohio, which is where he did my surgery. But to learn these surgeries, they would fly to Chicago.
Okay.
And he's like, we would practice. Basically, we would watch. And he was like, it was almost show and tell. And then we would go back into Toledo and perform these surgeries. Mind blowing.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. It was just so cool to hear his perspective as a physician, which he had a daughter who passed away from a CHD.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Okay. So it's all very intertwined.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I love all my interviews, but that one, I'm like, you're the unicorn here. Like, I can't believe this is full circle coming back. I mean, you did my surgery in 87.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was 4 years old.
Yeah.
So full circle back around. That was one that was like, holy crap.
A little mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you had any interviews like that?
I have had, they're all unique.
Yeah, I know.
And it's always interesting to me to hear, I mean, Dr. Thomas Glenn was, because he has HLHS and he's a cardiologist.
Okay, he is the younger guy at these conferences, yeah, right? Yeah, yeah. Okay.
He's got a beard.
Yeah.
Got a, you know, far better shape than mine is. Looks like he's put together a little better than I am. But, you know, interviewing him was amazing because he's lived with it and now he's working with children with it. Any of the physicians or the nurses I've interviewed who have the condition, their stories are always amazing to me because it's sort of like, most of them are, this is always what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And that strikes me as amazing. And, you know, also a little crazy because, you know, think about it, like if I'm stuck in a hospital for long periods of my life and I, every time I have to go to a doctor, I get stuck with needles and stuff. Mm-hmm. You figure at some point you develop some sort of adverse reaction to medical personnel or whatever. But these folks are like, oh, this is what I wanted to do. And you're like, well, God bless you. Kind of a thing.
I think that's the incredible part about people in that situation who know exactly where they want to go and what they want to be.
Yeah.
And their personal experience probably changes their perspective on how they treat a patient in a good way.
Oh, yeah.
I'll say absolutely 100% in a good way. Those people are like diamonds in the rough. And I think that's amazing.
Yeah. Is it, you know, one of the things I always come away with when I interview parents is the vast majority of parents I interview are ones who have gone on to start charities or do other stuff. And I've discovered we're kind of a weird breed. Like the vast majority of people I talk to. So, and I'm just going to talk because this is your podcast and mine. So
yeah, go ahead. Yes.
Normally I try to be quiet, but when this all started for me within, you know, an hour or two, I was posting on Facebook and I was just a constant stream of information out into the world. Whereas my wife and pretty much everybody else who I've ever talked to is just like, no, we kind of close off, we close ranks, we're just us. And I'm like, no, I have to tell it. It's just how I'm wired. I have to tell everybody. I have to get everybody on board. I have to, and I don't know if that's me reaching for help or if it's me just, that's how I deal with trauma. And so that's what I did. And so I've come to realize that's not usual. Like that seems to be pretty strange. for us to do that, because most people I talk to are like, yeah, if anything like that happened to me, I would just not tell anybody about it. And they'd find out a year later that something happened. And I was like, no, I'm texting people as I'm getting the information. I remember the first time I skipped an update, because I would give an update every day on Facebook on the page we made and everything. The first day I skipped an update because there wasn't anything that happened. And it was like, you know, everything's usual. Things are so slightly getting better, you know, or coming to the point where he can eat more on his own and everything. And I got a phone call from my dad. He was like, hey, you know, my friend from down the street saw you skip the day. Is everything okay? And I'm like, I realized at that point how many people were watching every day for news for what was going on.
Now, was this on your personal Facebook page or did you create?
It started on my personal Facebook page and eventually I created a page.
Okay.
Eventually I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting how many people become invested in you and your son and essentially your entire family?
Yeah.
They want to know that someone is doing well.
Yeah.
And I also think that's kind of one of the great things too, when you decide to press share and people decide to share. And I'm not saying I need all the likes in the world, but it's like people are seeing the content. I think that's the most important part. People are seeing the content. So it's awareness and they're seeing things are fantastic or things are just a little crummy right now.
Things are not great.
Yeah.
Like this day was terrible or this was good or.
And so let me ask this question. As a patient, posting the things that are crummy is hard for me because how I want to share my story, I also don't want it to be a pity party or, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry, or because I'm not. It is what it is. And this is the stage that I'm in, right? I'm just telling you the reality of what a congenital heart defect is and what HLHS you live with. How is that perspective for you? Is it easy for you to post the hard things? Maybe not easy is the right word, but I guess, how do you do that? And are you hoping those like, oh my gosh, things don't come in or you don't want the pity party? How does that look for you?
I try my best not to dwell on it. For me, it's information. And
good way to look at it.
The people who are paying attention are the ones who care. And if they care enough to pay attention, then in my mind, they deserve to know whatever the information is and however they react to it. Mm-hmm. If they want to react with, you know, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry, then I'll take it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Hey, good. You know, I'm not going to turn that back. If they don't react at all, then okay. And for me, it's not about whether or not I'm going to generate a pity party or tell people you should feel sorry for me because of this terrible thing that's happening. And that's not because, and I think there's a lot of genuineness and honesty that goes into that.
Mm-hmm.
If I used, you know, Facebook or Instagram or anything to do that kind of a thing, then number one, I wouldn't care. But like I wouldn't expect anybody else would care either.
Right.
But I'm not on there to do that. For me, it's about getting the word out. It's about, at the time, this was 2018. And so Facebook was still a very far more nice of a place than it is these days. I don't tend to go on it very much anymore, which I feel bad about because I know there's still people who watch the page and I don't post anything anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But just due to how politicized it's gotten, it's to me anymore, I go on there, then it takes me 10 minutes to scroll just to find a person and not an ad.
Yes.
And the platforms effectively become unusable, sadly. Mm-hmm. Not to say I don't still use it to post the podcast, but
sure.
I don't try to dwell on what other people's reactions are going to be because those are mine. Their reactions are theirs.
Yeah.
And the information is what's important. And I just want to get that out.
Yeah. That's a really good way to look at it. I think I'm so worried about that piece of it. What will people think or what will people think I'm asking or requesting of them?
Yeah.
And I'm not, like you said, I'm not asking or requesting anything. It's a good way to look at it. Just getting the information out there.
Yeah.
Good perspective.
Because, I mean, at the end of the day, when you go into a room and, you know, there's 100 people in that room, you know, 98 of those people are either ambivalent or are willing to be your friend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of them's a jack, you know, is a not nice person. And one of them is probably overly enthusiastic about making friends.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the reality of the situation. And we tend to worry that everybody is either the jerk or mm-hmm. whatever. But the reality is most people are fine with other people.
Yeah.
And I think we have a tendency as a culture, as a people, just as human beings, to drive ourselves into this sort of nervous wreck place where we think, you know, we walk in a room and we have to be anxious or scared or everybody's judging us. And the reality is nobody is. Everybody's judging themselves, worried about what other people are thinking about them, and are perfectly happy to be your friend.
Yeah.
So that's kind of attitude I've sort of adopted is when I walk into a room, I just assume everybody here wants to be my friend.
Mm-hmm.
So it's okay if I say something stupid.
That's a good way to look at it. I like that. Mm-hmm. I'm digging that one.
Yeah.
Because that's hard. For sure.
Yeah. You can get that way about the podcast too, right?
Yeah.
Do I post this? Like, did that person say the right thing at the right time? Is that the wrong thing to get out there? Do I really want to put out there? And I've had people answer questions where I was like, oh, that was kind of different than I expected it to be. But it's their answer.
I agree with that. There have been topics that have been touched that I don't necessarily agree with that same. I don't align with what they're saying. And I think I've talked to my husband about that. Will you please listen to this and tell me, like, I feel like I shouldn't cut it because, like you said, that's their thoughts and that's what they're thinking. I don't have to align with that, but those are theirs and that's okay. I think that's sometimes what's hard too about it because you're not expecting some things and it's like, oh, okay, which is fine. We don't all have to have the same view and the same perspective and align on everything. We never will.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. That's sometimes where it gets a little rough in the podcast. Yeah.
Yeah. So far, I've always gone forward with it.
Yeah.
I don't think it's worth pulling my hair out.
100%. It's because then you're not sharing the full story. You're not sharing the full them.
Right.
And I don't think that's fair to them either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think we've got enough manipulation of media that, you know, I'd rather be as genuine as I possibly can.
Yeah.
So I can at least be a trusted source.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I would agree with that. So your son is 9.
He's 9.
HLHS. And everything is going well.
Yeah, we're going pretty well.
Okay.
It's going pretty well. It got more real this last year coming out of the Fontan, you know, even coming out of the Glen, to be honest. You kind of go through this like fairy tale. I call it the honeymoon phase where it's like you get to pretend nothing's wrong as long as you don't have a bunch of equipment at home that you're having to deal with constantly, right? He's got a pacemaker. We only have to really check it every like 3 to 6 months. We take his blood oxygen every once in a while. We take him in for his stuff every 6 months or so.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, it's just not prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, and he was on aspirin, like 180 milligram or 82, whatever,
mm-hmm.
every day. And then they put him on blood pressure medicine. And so it's suddenly, oh, his blood pressure's up. Okay. Now we have to start thinking about, all right, so his blood pressure's up now. So what's the next thing? Because, you know, about 3 years ago, maybe it was a little longer, we closed his fenestration in his Fontan because his blood oxygen saturation on a good day was like 87. And you could tell.
Mm-hmm.
You could really start to tell it was hurting. Concerning his ability to be present and his ability to participate and to be active, to not turn blue when he was in the pool, all that stuff. And so it was like, okay, too much is getting shunted by the lungs, so we're going to close the fenestration. So we did that. When you do that, that's the trade. Higher blood oxygen concentration, which, you know, it jumped to like 93 to 95.
Mm-hmm.
But blood pressure is then what you got to start watching because you don't have that valve anymore, that pressure valve. And so that's where we're at.
Yeah.
We got there. It was faster than I wanted to be, but that's where we're at. It doesn't seem to be causing much problems. It's pretty low dose so far, but it's something we're watching.
When you say high blood pressure, like what is that?
Yeah.
Because I've never had that issue. So as far as I'm aware, so I'm curious, what is high at that age range,
I yeah. guess. So this is where you're gonna catch me with my pants down. Like, this is the my wife handles the numbers these days, and so I don't like. And I think I want to say I got asked this like last week or the week before, and they're like, "Well, what's high?" And I'm like, I meant to figure that out more recently, but I didn't.
Well, forget I asked. Just know it's high.
It's high. It's high. That's, yes.
Okay.
I don't know. I really don't.
I mean, I'm just thinking of adult, like what adult high would be.
Right.
I don't know what that difference would be in a child and one with Fontan to know what that is. Because I've always run low, but I'm going to say, you know, I run low because I'm on lisinopril due to heart failure, but clearly that's a blood pressure medication. Yeah. So mine always, in my adult life, it's always been low. So yeah, that's like polar opposite than what I'm used to.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, it's still very like low maintenance, right?
Sure. Yeah. But he's in sports. He's doing the things. Providers are telling him, push yourself until we can't go anymore.
Yeah. Fontan, you know, the Fontan Outcomes Network, soon to be SV1. I'm sure by the time this posts.
Yeah.
It'll be SV1. Single ventricle one.
Yeah. I think that's what it is. Yeah.
They put out last year, kind of a one pager that you could give to physicians or coaches or whatever that basically says, here's the deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the physical activity is extremely important for long-term outcomes for these kids. You can let them rest if they need to, but the reality is pushing them is a good thing. It gets their heart rate up. It gets their lung capacity better. One of the most impactful talks that I've gone to at an NPCQIC learning session was this exercise group. And at the very beginning of it, they had us all stand up and they had us sit down in the chair and they had us stand up again. And you weren't allowed to use your hands. You just sit and stand, right? And that's the sit stand test. Apparently that's a normal test.
Mm-hmm.
And you just do that as many times as you can for a minute. Right. And then they said, all right, put your hand on your heart. All right. Feel your heartbeat. And then ask yourself, is this normal?
Mm.
And the idea being that if you don't get your heart rate up on a regular basis, and then you suddenly do, then you've got no idea whether or not that feels normal or not. You have no experience base. So if you just take up running in your 40s and you've never run a mile and you get to the end of the mile and you're like, oh, I'm about to die because my heart feels like my heart's going to be out of my chest. That's what it feels like. And if you have some sort of complication in your medical history, like congenital heart defect, that complicates things astronomically if you don't know how your body works normally.
Mm-hmm.
And that really got it to me. It's like, okay, we've got to make sure he knows how his body feels at the extremes so that if something happens, he'll know.
One, I think that's awesome. I think the fact that providers are pushing it more is amazing. I know we had like a slight conversation before we started this recording, how it is so important for us to work out and it should be pushed more. And we as individuals should be pushed more. And that just wasn't the case when I was younger 30 years ago. And I don't know how it happened to me. I wish I could remember the day. I recall my parents always telling me, the provider said, she will tell you when she's tired. She will tell you when she can't go anymore. That's when you say, okay, sit down, relax. And then you'll go again. But as an adult, to physically know your body and say, this is not normal. I wish I could recall the day that I remember it all clicking and knowing, okay, if this beat feels funky, I know something's not right. Or whatever the case may be, you just know in your body, it's wrong. I don't know when that happened. But now that providers are doing this and saying what feels normal, what doesn't, I mean, every kid can learn to be in tune with their body.
Yeah.
And know what feels weird and is not right. I mean, in 2014, 15, I was taken off amiodarone because I hadn't had an episode in quite a while. I was on 200 milligrams.
Okay, what's that for? Just
arrhythmia.
Okay.
Yes. I had AFib.
Okay.
So my provider had taken me off of it and she's like, oh, it's got a 6-month lifespan. Like it'll be in there for a while. Okay. Well, I'll believe you. And it was within a month. I was going in every other month to be cardioverted.
Okay.
And this lasted probably about a year. It came to a point where I went into Children's one day. It was after hours. And I was just like, I can't take this anymore. I probably shouldn't have drove. And I'm like, I am at my wit's end. I went in. I was probably right around 4:35 when the office was getting ready to close. And someone came out and they're like, can we help you? And I'm like, I need help. Who is here that can help me? And her name is Tracy Sisk. She came out and she's like, what's going on? And I'm like, Tracy, I'm done. I don't know what to do anymore. I want to give up. And it was one of the first times as an adult where I felt mentally, physically, emotionally drained. And there was just nothing else I could do. I recall telling my sister, I wish I would close my eyes and not wake up. Like, that's how exhausting it was. And she looked at me and she said, give me 1 second. She went back and she got Dr. Daniels, and Dr. Daniels brought me back. And he said, you know, we talked through everything. He's like, what's going on? I told him and I said, I'm done. And he was like, he's like, we'll get it. We'll get it fixed. He's like, I'll direct admit you now. But for me, I probably let it wait too long at that point in 14 and 15, just trusting the fact that I should be able to go off this medication and everything should be fine.
Yeah.
But it wasn't fine. And then just getting to that point. So I was a very young adult, again, probably not knowing 100% what should have been happening, but then finally saying, I'm done. And I think at that moment, even before then, I know the providers trusted what I was saying and they knew what I was saying was real. But I think at that moment, it was this point of true trust. Like, Amy is going to say when she is done.
Yeah.
And probably now, long before a year, right? I've let it go way too long.
Yeah.
But that's the other thing. I think when you do and you are so in tune with your body and you can tell the physicians what it is, they truly, believe is not the right word, because I don't want to ever say they don't believe you, but they know that you're like, okay, this is real.
Right.
She's done.
It's sort of like, I think there's a difference between, I'll kind of kick it over to my current role as a manager at a power plant, but when a guy comes and tells me, okay, the pump's bad, I'm like, okay, what do you mean by that? And he says, well, there's this and this and this. I'm like, okay. Hard hat on, let's go have a look. And I can walk up to it and I can hear it and I can feel it and I can see it and I have them start and stop it. I'm like, okay, there's a difference, right? There's a difference between, and it's not that I didn't believe the guy.
Mm-hmm.
I believed him. The pump was bad, but it didn't register in the same place in my mind as when I saw it, heard it, and everything.
Yeah.
I think as a physician, you're kind of in this position where, okay, everything everybody says about their body is, at least in some, are subjective. So how much do I take in from that person? And how much do I put that in this is pure evidence that I can put into the pile of stuff I'm trying to use to diagnose the problem? And how much is this sort of fuzzy evidence that is sort of like, I should take this into account, but this isn't maybe the necessary thing I need for my diagnosis?
Mm-hmm.
I think as physicians, all of them struggle with that. I think, in my opinion, the better ones do a lot better job figuring that out, where that place is. But you do, I find there is a place that you can get, and this is just with my own doctors that I've dealt with over the years, that where they believe what you say.
Yeah.
And they take it and you can tell they're putting it in that hard evidence pile.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this person isn't telling me this because they're kind of feeling a little funny today. This person's telling me this because they've been like this for however many months.
Yeah.
And they understand what the problem is, and this is real.
Yeah. Yep. I think that's the, like you said, with your providers, for people who have a longevity at their hospital, I think that also does wonders, because it's not like, oh, I've been there for 2 years and evidence-based, however you want to look at it, because they don't know me really personally either. I'm coming once a year, twice a year, depending on your defect. So, I've been at Children's since I was like 12. So it's there. And the relationship, I'll say the relationship is there. And I think that's really important too, for the trust piece in both physician to patient and patient to physician. I think that's huge.
Yeah. And parents as well. I'll throw that in just to
100%.
Because a lot of times they, we get in the same spot. We're like, no, he is acting different.
Yeah.
There is a difference here.
Well, and when you're looking at your son, for example, he's 9. He's still learning.
Right.
So you are his advocate. you are his spokesperson who has to say, this is not normal.
Yeah, this is off.
Yeah.
There's something wrong with here. Yeah.
Oh, that would be really hard as a parent. I don't know. I think so often, how the heck did my parents do it?
They're amazing people. I mean, I existed in a world where, like, when we had Micah, that there was at least the bare minimum of stuff out there about what the condition was, you know, what the paths forward were. I was able to, you know, within a couple hours to find, I think it was either Mayo Clinic or something else that had this is the three stages that goes through. This is what the future looks like, which is what you wonder, at least what I wondered as a parent. Mm-hmm. You know, I had immediate access to Facebook and to call my parents. Like, just the fact that I have my phone in my pocket, right? That I don't have to find a phone on a wall somewhere and remember everybody's phone number to call. And to think, like, your parents were in the 80s. Like, I don't know how, like, super, super people, as far as I'm concerned.
Right? I mean, like you said, you think you could Google. What did we have? Encyclopedia
Britannica. Yeah. 47 volume.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? Like, what are you going to find?
Yeah.
What are you going to find? Yes. I would, the 80s, yes. Holy crap. I would agree with you there. For sure.
Yeah.
It was a different world.
Different time.
But we survived.
Yes.
We survived.
Somehow got here.
Yes.
What brought you into the NPCQIC? Like, how did you find out about them and then get involved?
Through the single ventricle page on Facebook.
Okay.
Amanda Harper is part of it. And I knew her. I was friends with her on Facebook because she did something with ACHA. I feel like it was ACHA. And we had a couple of gatherings in Ohio, which is how I met her and became Facebook friends with her. And then getting into the single ventricle page on Facebook, I think she had posted it. Okay. And it came up. And I don't even know why all of a sudden I had said, I want to go. I think it just piqued my interest. You know what piqued my interest was a single ventricle day.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, if I could meet people, that would be really cool. Not knowing how many people I would actually meet. And then after year one, I'm sad I didn't know about it years before. Because what? This has been going on for how long?
Well, I mean, single ventricle day is fairly new.
Yes, the NPCQIC.
Yeah, it's been... I think we went to our first in 2017, 2018.
Yeah.
Was our first. Yeah.
Look, right. But I mean, and there had to have been patients coming within that time. Yeah. Maybe not every year all the time. Right. The network was there. So to not know about it really, truly until 2 years ago, I feel like I missed out on a lot, yeah. But now I'm hooked. So now I'm going every year.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's how I learned about it.
Yeah.
How'd you learn about it as a parent?
So one of the things I got to a place, so, and it's funny, when you're in the NICU, you have a lot of time on your hands. I got this from another parent who had a child early and was in the NICU and said, well, no, we don't want to bother them. And then the wife was like, you know what NICU time is like. You're just in there not doing much. And so it's very true. Like, there's a lot going on, but there's also not. Mm-hmm. And so during the downtimes, I was like, well, what could I do? Practically speaking, what could I do? Part of what came out of that was the Micah Mason Foundation and sort of that. And then sort of the follow on from that was like, well, if I'm going to collect money for organizations who are researching this stuff, well, I got to go find those organizations. And so NPCQIC was one of the first I came in contact with.
Okay.
And the first one we went to is actually because, you know, it's in Cincinnati because they're very tied in with the children's in Cincinnati.
Yes.
And my wife's grandparents live there. And we were visiting at the time the conference was going on. So it was like, let's just go.
Yeah.
And so we did. So that was the first one we went to. And it's funny because I met a bunch of people there who were still involved. A lot of people who are not as involved in it, like Stacey Lynn's kind of stepped back.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the other people, Lacey, who's kind of picked up on Sisters by Heart, and that's something my wife was involved in. I met Dr. Tim Nelson there, who eventually... At the time, it was the time of Karen Wanak Foundation, but now it's HeartWorks, which is its own big, huge thing now.
Yeah.
And so, like, it was funny. That became a real connection point for me, putting together pieces of people I needed to keep in contact with, organizations I needed to keep hold of. Because at that conference, 2017, they were talking about phase 3 or phase 4, which at the time, in my mind, that's what Quantan Outcomes was. it didn't actually turn out that way. Fontaine Outcomes Network kind of started on their own.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of that was sort of because NPC wasn't moving fast enough, in their opinion.
Okay.
And now we're kind of coming together as SB1. But originally, like, this was supposed to be one organization. But I don't know if we would have gotten as far as fast as we did without the movement of some of the people involved.
It's really cool.
Yeah. There's another couple of parents who were really big advocates for how quickly this stuff moved forward. And some of the other source that's come out of it, or the source project, which is, I can't remember the name of the group they're actually part of, but that's basically what I spent a lot of my time finding other organizations. Okay, we're going to hook up with them. So let's reform our relationship with NPCQIC, which is sort of a participatory relationship. We formed our relationship with the Children's Heart Foundation, which is more of a funding relationship. We actually some of the way I get people to interview is through the Heart Foundation, because they do sponsor research. And so they have their researchers that occasionally will agree to let me interview them.
Yeah.
And then through the HeartWorks as well, when that sort of sprang out of Todd and Karen Wanak Foundation.
That's wild.
I will say it's been fun, joyous, watching the organization sort of blossom. And being able to kind of, at this point, report on them is effectively put the podcast on.
Yeah.
You know, Feisty, watching the various individuals, very driven people who kind of push things forward, and then watching them hand the torch off to the next group of people who will then push them forward, seeing the things grow. I'm over the moon excited about SB1.
Yeah.
Well, this is where we've needed to be so long, because by the time we found NPCQIC, it was 2017, like it was 2 years old. He's already passed what they cared about at that time, because they were up to the first birthday. And then phase three was beyond that.
Yeah.
And, you know, phase two was after Interstage. Interstage was the very first thing. And seeing that finally come about, where it's a full lifelong monitoring, giving the data into large modeling programs, so we could figure out what's the best solution for making sure that these problems are problems later in life.
Yeah.
And to me, it's wonderful. It's like a combination of like the best parts of all of the new technology that are coming out, right? The interconnection technology, the ability to do Zoom, to get on, you know, meetings, call people, instantaneous communications, the AI stuff, large language models, the machine learning. You know, all that stuff. And we're all very anxious about being killed by robots eventually. But in the meantime, they can all be used for very important things. And I think it's kind of wonderful to watch that happen.
Right. And to know that your son is still young enough to really reap these benefits, I think that is the most awesome thing about it. Not that I can't reap any benefits, but I think that's the thing, right? Like, we're getting started in better time.
Yeah.
I guess. I mean, we're not wasting it anymore. I think as an adult too, you know, you saying, because I really didn't know the history about it, you saying it's the whole life, it's the longevity of the life. I think as an adult, that's one of the things that's really hard too, because I think a lot of people focus on baby.
Can I get you through the really crazy stuff? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But then it's like after that, it's not that they don't care, but we just kind of fall off. And it's, oh, we'll see you and let's hope this is working and we'll get you to this next stage. And then when this happens, we'll figure out what to do when it happens, not prior to.
Yeah.
So you saying this SB1 is changing all of that and this is where we should be. I'm just learning all this. So as an adult, it's kind of like, holy crap, the mindset is shifting. And not that they didn't care before, but they're realizing the focus is over here is also really, really important. And as an adult HLHSer, it's just kind of really surreal that, I don't want to say that people are caring, but it's people are caring.
Yeah.
Because we are getting older. I mean, who would have thought some of us would be in our 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Right.
Highly doubt a lot of people did.
Right.
Especially only for myself, I only had the Fontan. I didn't have the Norwood and the Glen. It was
Oh, really?
Yes. So, like, I got the BTT shunts and then the Fontanne at 4.
Okay.
And that is the only open heart surgery I've ever had. And shockingly enough, a lot of the people I've interviewed, they've only had one.
Huh.
Yeah.
And well, yeah, because at the very beginning stages, there was like Norwood / Glenn.
Yeah. Or yeah, the modify.
Yeah.
Yeah. All that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, the fact that it's just grown to that point because they're whatever they did 30 years ago, 35 years ago, clearly worked. So let's see these patients through to their 60s, because I'm not going to lie, I would love to be sitting on a front porch in my 80s with my coffee.
Yeah. Yeah.
And enjoying
drinking my non-alcoholic mint julep.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
100%. So I think that's really cool to know the backstory of that too, because I didn't know the backstory of them.
I actually got to interview one of the physicians. She really pioneered the interstage investigation work.
Mm-hmm.
This was prior to NBCQIC. And I got to interview her about her work that she did. And I was doing this for the Children's Heart Foundation as one of their webinars. And I realized halfway through the interview, oh my goodness, this woman is the one who put together the foundational work for NBCQIC. Towards the end, I was like, have you heard of this organization? She's like, oh, yeah. And that was part of the research I did. And I was like, okay, I put that together correctly. That's, and it's wonderful to me to see is, because in my mind, what I always say is, I don't care what doctor or surgeon or whatever figures out the solution, right? What I care about is that somebody figures it out. Mm-hmm. And I don't care if you work at CHOP, and I don't care if you work at Mayo, and I don't care if you work at Florida General. I don't care. I care that it happens.
Yeah.
And to see, at least within the physicians community, within cardiac, especially CHD, adult CHD, this move, and, you know, nobody would ever say out loud, oh, yeah, we were all intern, we wanted our hospital to do it. But everybody was that way, especially people who own the hospitals. But this move to more of a collaborative thing, like, we're not going to figure it out unless we do it together. And to watch everybody coming in with that as a baseline, I don't have to sell that message to anybody. Everybody understands that that is the only way forward.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's the most wonderful thing.
I would agree. The first year, I'll include the second year I went. The amount of physicians that are there, I know all the physicians care, right? And they're there for a reason. You became a physician, a doctor of cardiology, whatever, because you have some sort of passion there, whatever. It was a drive. But when I went and saw everyone from literally all over the country, that was one of the things that I thought to myself, like, these people actually care.
Yeah, they care.
They are here on top of their normal whatever, spending time away from their family, trying to figure it out for other families whom are not their own. I mean, goosebumps for me personally, because to know that there are people out there, you may not have anything to do with the CHG board personally, but for you, it means something and it's true.
Yeah.
And that's what you're spending your time doing. And you're taking time away from your family to be at a conference for 3 days. It's almost a feeling of unbelievable that humans are capable of doing that for others, but that's their passion in life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're communal apes. We're communal beings.
You're true.
But I think beyond that, I think we really, not just as a, you could look at it as, okay, it's just necessary for us to function, and it is. But that's just necessary. We do better when we're in community, and we do so much better when we really care.
Mm-hmm.
We really do. And you can watch it play out. I think NPCQIC is one of the forefront organizations within the medical community at large that sort of showcases, if you bring the doctors and the surgeons and the patients and the parents and whoever else is invested together, the results are really good.
Yeah. And the fact that they want to hear from the patients now, this is our issue. This is what we need. This is what we need to hear and understand. I think that is one of the biggest things too. For so long, you just don't ever feel like you're heard and someone is finally hearing you. Yeah. I don't even know what to say about it. I just think it's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are you excited about in the CHDQA we've seen? What have people been talking about that you're interested in?
So I think as I get older, I really like learning about exercise and how much that can do for the patient. That is one topic I'm really interested in. The other topic you had mentioned, HeartWorks, like they're a piece that I've recently gotten to know and really just understanding what they're doing in their research. I clicked on the link to talk to Tim Nelson, and he was one of the nicest human beings.
He's wonderful.
And honestly, genuinely cared about what I had to say. I didn't feel like, oh, he's just doing this to do this. He cared.
Yeah.
And he listened to my story and had great questions for me. And I was on a Zoom call. And the fact that he's just like, we're doing this for you. We're doing this for adults. And it's just some of the things he says makes everything seem so, this can happen. Things right. can happen.
Right.
Like things can be real. It's not going to be overnight, but this is a possibility. So I would really like to start learning more about them and what they're doing and being a part of their research studies, which I will be in a week, not even 4 days. So that's the exciting part for me in CHD, diving deeper into learning. I think there's so many people out there, like you have so much knowledge. There's so many CH parents and patients that have so much knowledge. So I'm like, how do you know that? Where do you get that from? Where are you learning all these facts and these getting these articles? Because I was never shown how, I shouldn't say shown how to do that. That just wasn't anything my parents were involved in or that I know how to be involved in. It's literally by word of mouth in my 40s on Facebook platforms. That's how it is.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think that's exciting for the future.
I would agree. I've been watching HeartWorks for a long time, as long as I can have.
Mm-hmm.
And watching them grow and move towards their goals and accomplish goals, mm-hmm. and they continue to move towards the one that they once they originally expressed. And knowing where they were going, like, because I remember talking with Dr. Nelson a long time ago about, like, what's the goal here? Like, mm-hmm. what's your goal? And he's, you know, effectively it is full-blown replacement with your own heart. Or shy of that, you know, building something inside of your artery structure that can provide the same pumping power, effectively, because that's what's lacking. And then watching him, or I shouldn't say him, because it's a huge team,
mm-hmm.
watching the HeartWorks team move towards that goal. I don't know, I've been part of projects that just died on the line or didn't go anywhere or sort mm-hmm. of petered out. And watching them move forward consistently, making progress consistently, has been so hard. Like, I've always had this love, the fact that like Micah is only 9 now and he will eventually get this stuff. And
yeah.
is just down the line for him.
Mm-hmm.
It's not right now, but I really think they're going to provide a real solution for adults. And that's so exciting.
Wow. Like, it really is. The fact that modern medicine is capable of doing it, mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and the crazy part is their model is so different. Like, the vast majority of modern medicine is done in research labs that are owned by large-scale pharmaceutical or device companies that are trying to make a profit.
Mm-hmm.
And HeartWorks is a charity.
Yeah.
Because their market is so, quote-unquote, small
mm-hmm.
that, you know, the bigger companies would never take it on.
Yeah.
And yet they're still progressing and moving forward and making strides. And, like, it's so nice.
Mm-hmm. And, well, this study that I'm going to be a part of a couple months ago, we were on a Zoom call and they're like, now 100% the reasoning for 100 patients before September or the end of the year, I'm not quite sure. I'm not going to talk on that and do misinformation. But that was the goal.
Mm-hmm.
And they, at the time, I think had less than 25. I know it was less than 25 because they're like, we need to get here. They had posted something on their Facebook page the other day that there's 56 that have already done it. Not necessarily the ones that are scheduled, the ones that are going to be scheduled. Because even after I posted that on my Facebook page, here comes the conversation from other CHD patients. How do I do it? Where is it at? Do I have to travel here? How does that work?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it is. It's, you know, posting as awareness and getting the word out there so these new innovations can move forward.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's really freaking exciting. I agree. I'm excited for it.
Trying to think of what my other questions are normally at this point.
I know. I think this has been a good conversation. Yeah. I think the conversation in general. I love a podcast with dialogue,
yeah,
personally.
I do too.
So this has been fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really appreciate it. I'm glad that you are in Columbus. And I'm glad that you hit me up on Facebook and was like, hey, let's do this.
Yeah, I am too. I'm sorry it took me so long to get around it. My brain is so scattered these days.
Listen, life happens. Life happens. I also did not reach out to you. So there we go.
That's true. All right.
It's true.
Same boat.
Take the blame. Yes, it both taking planes for that one. But here we are. You had to travel from Texas to Columbus to get it done. That's all you had to do.
It's okay.
So yeah.
We got it done.
Absolutely. Fantastic. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
You are so welcome. And thank you. I appreciate you coming over and doing this so we can get it done and wrapped up in bow.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was fun.
Thank you, dear listener, for joining us for this episode of Sharing the Hope from the Micah Mason Foundation. If you'd like to find out more about Amy's podcast, check out Diaries of a Heart Warrior, wherever fine podcasts are sold. To support this podcast, Sharing the Hope, head over to the website micahmasonfoundation.org and click on the donate button.